Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. During our second hour, we're going to settle in for a conversation about ethics, not just in government, but in business and healthcare, law and journalism. Everyone's talking about ethics lately and oversight, so we've convened a panel of experts. With me in the studios at the University of Sioux Falls, I have Steve Priest. He is with Integrity Insight International. The Wall Street Journal called him, quote, one of the most sought consultants to keep companies on the straight and narrow. Steve Priest, welcome to In the Moment.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, Lori.
And then we have, next to Steve, Bob Freeberg. He's an attorney and counsel for the South Dakota State Bar Association Disciplinary Board. Bob, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And moving on, we have Laura Black. She is Senior Director for Clinical Research at Sanford Research. Dr. Black? Doctor? Laura Black.
Unfortunately, no. Yep.
See, I made a jump there that I didn't. Laura Black, welcome as well.
Thank you.
And then finally, in the corner, my journalism professor from Augustana University, back when it was Augustana College. That's our full disclosure moment. We have Janet Blank Libra with Augie. She's a professor and director of journalism. She's the author of Pursuing an Ethic of Empathy in Journalism. It's been a while, Janet, since I was in college and had transferred from my education in Hawaii to come finish up at Augie, so it's nice to see you again.
I remember it well, Lori.
Thanks for showing up for me.
Always. Right.
So let's start.
Questionable judgment there.
See, I think if we're transparent about the fact that we know each other, we're following one of those rules of ethics, I think. We're going to start with transparency, I think, in a minute, but let's talk about ethics in general. And when we have this conversation, everybody's talking about it in state government. Everybody's talking about it with a new president. As we look at cabinet approvals, that happens, I think, with every president in cabinet approvals. There's questions and answers about ethics. So what does the word even mean? And what do we talk about when we talk about ethics? Let's start with Steve Priest.
Well, you know, when people are trying to trap me, they say define ethics, because in our postmodern age, people go crazy with definitions. But I think in the field that I do, that I've done work in for 30 years, the field of business ethics and organizational ethics, it comes down to doing the right thing. It really is as simple as doing the right thing. But then what does that mean? You can go back to what I learned from my dad in his retail store on my dad is, by the way, an Aberdeen native, but this retail store was in Neenah, Wisconsin, Main Street of Neenah, Wisconsin. And he said, if you treat your customers right and your employees right, the profits will flow. And that's not a very nuanced definition, but it's a pretty good starting place. Treat other people right. Follow the law. I think we'll hear a little bit about that in a minute. And think about how others will consider your actions, and you'll end up doing okay.
Is one of the first questions people ask you tied to profitability?
Well, you know, if you're in business, or even if you're in a tax-exempt institution like Sanford, you still have to make money.
Right.
A nun who ran this great healthcare system, Sister Irene Krauss, taught me, no margin, no mission, no mission, no margin. Huh. So every organization needs to have a margin. And the good thing is, I've done work in 51 countries around the world. When you ask people, even in countries that are notorious for unethical behavior, like China or India or Russia, what businesses thrive in the long term, they say businesses that do the right thing, businesses that act ethically. Short term, of course, you can cheat and steal your way to success, and we have lots of examples of that. But long-term, the businesses that last are the ones that that act ethically.
All right. Let's bring in Bob Freeberg, attorney, works with the South Dakota State Bar Association on the disciplinary board. When I say ethics, what do you think about?
Well, that's sort of the heart of what lawyers are supposed to do, and it's all aimed to make our system of the rule of law work. So that you don't have any choice about whether to follow the ethical rules or rules of professional responsibility. They're mandatory. If you violate them, you may incur some kind of censor for that. But more importantly, if those rules are not applied vigorously and regularly, the system gets corrupted so that people lose their confidence in the system and the commitment that we have in this country to the rule of law is corrupted. So every lawyer, every judge has an obligation to see that the rules that we have to live by are applied and regularly applied.
Bob, how important is that you don't have a choice element of this? How important is it to take away the decision making from some of the basic fundamentals of obeying those rules?
Well, I don't think that's an issue because all of those rules are aimed to protect integrity and honesty. So, you know, if you want to be a lawyer, you have to tell the judge the truth.
Yeah.
If you want to be a lawyer, you have to keep confidences of your clients.
Right.
So you don't have any choice about those things. Now, there are nuances, obviously, and how do you interpret all this, but there's a whole body of jurisprudence dealing with all of those things, so it's... But it's pretty fundamental, basically, to the practice of law.
How intricate is it? You must have to study it quite a bit before you even become a lawyer so that you know where those boundaries are.
You do. You have to take a course in your law school. You have to pass an exam that is focused entirely on professional responsibility. So... yeah, if you don't know how to do that, when you come out of law school, if you don't at least know what the rules are, you're not going to be admitted to practice. Hmm. And that's kind of the bottom line for the profession.
All right. Laura Black, Sanford, Senior Director for Clinical Research. So when I say ethics, how does that interact with your world?
Sure. I was thinking about that before I came in. It impacts so many different facets of what I do professionally speaking within the context of clinical research. We think of ethics as subject or participant protections and all of the boundaries and regulations that apply to human subjects research. In the terms of biomedical ethics, which I also participate in, it's very much like Steve and Bob said, in that you're trying to do the right thing. However, it's more focused towards the patient in healthcare, so making sure that we're doing right by the patients. And I'm sure that everyone has heard the do no harm. That's one of the tenets of biomedical ethics. So we really focus in on the patient, and then in the research world, we focus in on the participant.
Define biomedical.
Sure.
When we use that word. And jurisprudence, let's define that too. First, biomedical, let's make sure we all are speaking the same language.
Sure. So anything that relates to the intersection between a biological, so it could be, it's primarily human biology, but that along with the medical care. So you could think about medical care in terms of traditional hospitals, clinics, but you can also think about things like public health. So population-based interventions, public policy, which I'm sure Bob is very familiar with
as well. Jurisprudence, Bob.
It's just really a body of literature of the law. Okay. It includes case law decided by the courts. It includes treatises and law reviews, all of that sort of, we might call it the academic side of the legal profession. So it's just a body of literature and information that lawyers have built up over, well, since 1066 or shortly thereafter.
A long-standing tradition. Also, if you have a question for us, you can send us a text to any of our members of our ethics panel. 956-SDPB is where you send that, or send me an email in the moment at sdpb.org. We're going to take phone calls, too, in just a minute. We'll give you that number. But first, Janet Blank-Libra, we're going to talk about journalism and media ethics a little bit. When we talk about ethics and the media, what comes to your mind first?
I think about why it is that I believe it's so important that I teach students how to approach challenging situations. They should have in hand a number of ways of approaching that situation ethically, and how they then choose to approach a situation is going to determine their conduct, and that has everything to do, as Bob said, with integrity in the end. Have they given full consideration to what the situation means in terms of what they're going to be doing as reporters and in terms of whoever's involved in the story, the participants in the story? How do they apply ethics in any given situation?
I did an independent study for ethics with you, and we went through it case by case together, and I remember spending hours in your office just going through all those. I was probably super annoying,
so thank you
for that. But it's a lot of individual stuff that you have to sort through and really think like a chess game several steps ahead. What happens if I do this? What does that mean? And some of them in journalism seem so easy. What I mean by that is you make a little decision about what you put in a picture without thinking going forward. Yeah. Do you think American journalism is particularly challenged by ethics right now? We certainly hear our presidents saying things and calling people out. Do you think some of that's rhetoric? Do you think some of that's fair?
I do think that we're particularly challenged right now and in a million different ways. And I think one of the most important ways in which we're challenged and that we need to respond to is in the way in which we cover vulnerable populations, which is one of the reasons that I've been so interested in an ethic of empathy, because if we come to our work ethically as journalists predominantly through an objective lens, then we distance ourselves automatically from the other or from the subject. And if we approach a story through an ethic of empathy, we decrease that distance. We eliminate that distance to the best of our ability and get closer to the subject as opposed to removed from it. And I think that good journalists do that quite naturally. But I think that the profession or the discipline has taught young journalists to be objective and objective only, even though I think, again, quite naturally, many journalists are empathetic in their work.
There's a huge amount of research in the business ethics field about that if you personalize the other, if you personalize the customer, if you personalize, even if you're a high-level executive VP and you personalize the person on the front line, the employee on the front line, you increase the likelihood they'll make better ethical decisions.
So, yeah. So Steve, extend that to technology when you talk about lawmakers. Who do they need to personalize then? Voters? Citizens? Constituents?
You know, this has been a really difficult year to do business ethics because as I started out, you know, I talked about how doing the right thing matters and your reputation matters if you want to succeed long term. And in national politics, we've seen examples of behaviors that many people, whether it doesn't matter what your political persuasion is, would say don't meet the high level of ethical expectations that at least good South Dakotans would have. I think part of the problem, and this is a problem in the legal profession as well, is that although it's very clear, Bob said it beautifully, that these rules are in place to protect the honesty and integrity and trust in the profession, they're often the discussion just goes down to the rules. And was this or that behavior a violation of this rule or law or regulation? And we all know, one company I worked with said, it should not be our goal to get through the day by avoiding an indictment. You know, our goal should be to get through the day building stronger relationships of trust with the people we deal with. Yeah. And I think that's been lost. I shouldn't say lost. I think it's something we as voters need to make clear we care about when we're electing and talking to our elected officials.
I want to continue this thread that Janet started about vulnerable populations. And when How about advocacy? Does that cross an ethical line, especially when you're dealing with a vulnerable group of people, you're covering a story, you're working with folks? Is the temptation there to slip into empathy and advocacy, Janet? You play with those two words for a minute.
I don't think you necessarily have to slip into advocacy if you're being empathetic. To be empathetic is not to be biased. It's to attempt to get closer to another human being, to understand his or her perspectives as he or she does, to connect with his or her feelings and feel them in yourself. And that's not advocacy, and it doesn't have to lead necessarily to advocacy. It can simply lead a journalist to ask better questions, perhaps, ones that have that bring forward that individual's voice in a stronger, more authentic way.
Laura,
I think there's a good question about the vulnerable populations. In South Dakota, for example, we've got a serious problem about legal representation for the folks that are stuck in the reservation. And we have a serious concern about people who live remotely, small towns, ranches, a long ways from a lawyer, and don't get any opportunity for legal assistance, which is bad for them individually. It's also bad for their little communities. Mm-hmm. So there is a movement going on now under the leadership of our Chief Justice to get lawyers out into places other than Sioux Falls, Rapid City, Huron, and Aberdeen. So we're hopeful that'll work, but it took a lot of work. It's taking money from the lawyers, from the legislature, and from the counties in which these communities are located to try to help these young lawyers pay for the debt they incurred in the course of getting their education.
Sure.
And so it's working, it's expanding, and that's going to help. The other part of it is that there's a real concern here, I think, in Sioux Falls particularly, about minority populations. The anti-Muslim stuff that's going on in society. Tanisa Islam is a Muslim lawyer who lives here. You may be familiar with her, all of you.
We heard her voice on the show earlier today.
Yes, we
today
did. We did
she
hear
testified
and
in here. Yes, uh-huh.
She's a very bright, dedicated mm-hmm. person. She's an American, and she hurts every day because she sees her brothers and sisters who happen to be Muslim marginalized, fearful about what's going on, and. So I think lawyers are pretty sympathetic to that, and many lawyers give a lot of their own time without compensation. And the other big issue that happens for lawyers everywhere is the domestic abuse stuff, you know, particularly for women who are abused and their kids, and to try to get legal assistance for them. Again, most of those folks don't have any money. So it becomes a voluntary effort, and the lawyers are pretty good about it to try to balance that between paying the overhead and taking care of your own family. But it's sometimes it's a real test to live up to the aspirations that lawyers have when the mechanics of our society sometimes just burden you down to try to get around that. And I think Steve's nodding here. I think he sees that probably in the business world as well.
As well. We're going to take a quick break here. We've got a panel of experts here talking about ethics. Laura Black with Sanford, Steve Priest with Integrity Insight International, Janet Blank-Liber with Augustana University, and attorney Bob Freeberg. Stick around. We'll have more on ethics after the break. You're in the moment, South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending the hour talking about ethics. We have a panel of experts convened here at the University of Sioux Falls at the SDPB studios. There we have Janet Blank-Libro, who is an Augustana University professor and director of journalism. She's the author of the book, Pursuing an Ethic of Empathy in Journalism. Next to her, we have Laura Black. She's senior director for clinical research at Sanford Research. Bob Freeberg, attorney and counsel for the South Dakota State Bar Association Disciplinary Board. And Steve Priest, he's with Integrity Insight International. I'm going to quote the Wall Street Journal again. one of the most sought consultants to keep companies on the straight and narrow. 51 countries around the world, Steve. Let's talk about transparency now and how important, because obviously there's privacy issues in law and medicine and business and journalism with sources. Let's talk about the role of transparency in a culture of integrity. Steve, you want to start us off?
Sure. Transparency has been a buzzword in the ethics world and the social world, organizational world now for, 10 or 20 years. And I think it's almost overhyped. Transparency above all. Well, so in the little world I live in, most of my work is with huge multinational companies, 20, 30, 50, 100,000 people. And when I talk to employees, one of the things they look for in a culture of integrity is the ability to be candid and the ability to be open. And one of the ways that that happens is when that's mirrored by their leaders, that they're open and candid. But everybody knows that there's a limit to transparency. If we're in merger negotiations, we don't talk about that. If we're in government, we've got Donald Trump screaming now, and we're talking a lot about intelligence agencies, you don't disclose sources or things that could endanger your ability to get future intelligence in the interest of transparency. Every one of our fields has transparency as a compass, as a north, a true north, but there are always exceptions. I'd love to hear about the exceptions from in these other fields from these other experts.
Well, I think just recently, the furor here in Sioux Falls about the settlement for the panel disruptions on the Sanford Center, and the city entered into a settlement agreement, and part of that agreement was that they could not disclose the terms of that agreement, and the Argus leader particularly wanted to find out what those were, and as I understand it, at this point, those can still be confidential matters. But really? The other side of that, of course, is what the city attorney said, and I think some other folks as well, was, well, if we can't have this confidentiality, we can't get these matters settled because people don't want to admit liability. And I think that's true not only in the public sector, I think it's also true in all kinds of activities where there are claims made and settlements made. We hear about that, I think, in the medical area. We hear about that in industrial accidents. We hear about that in all kinds of ways where the confidentiality becomes part of the way to try to make people whole. And
does that circle back to what you were saying earlier about sort of the erosion of trust?
Sure. I think people are suspicious about that. Obviously, the Argus leader was very suspicious about that settlement just because they don't know what happened. And I understand that. And that's a valid argument.
And that's the dark side, is that people say, I don't want to betray a confidence, when it's really they don't want to be embarrassed.
I think the rubric would be for the medical people, where we have a medical malpractice or a legal malpractice, any place where there's a professional claim for malpractice. If there is a bona fide claim, and if people have been damaged, the folks who have caused that want to get it resolved, and they want to get it resolved without embarrassing the good points. Also, without creating an atmosphere where people begin to mistrust because of the accident or the occurrence or the mishap that caused the problem. So, there's a real incentive for the folks who did the harm to remedy that. And if they can, in the process, with money, make the person whole or as close to whole as they can, then it seems for them a small price to request that that be kept in confidence.
Janet, I'm guessing that when we talk about things like how the Argus Leader reported on the Sanford Premier Center's business dealings and other issues of you know, sort of making damages go away and embarrassment, I'm thinking that you would have some thoughts on that that you wanted to add from a journalism professor standpoint.
I think that any time the public has a vested interest in a topic, there needs to be as much transparency as possible. And I think the public has a vested interest in the Premier Center. And so the more information, the better. I think that transparency is a word that has to do with a lot of things in journalism, and it has to do with the way in which the journalist conducts him or herself. Every source that a journalist sits down with should know what it is that that individual, that journalist, has in mind to do. I've talked with a lot of sources who have told me that, you know, as soon as they've sat down with a journalist, they've felt very, very vulnerable, and that they expect that the interview will go in a particular way, that they're going to get asked a lot of questions, and that the expectation is that it will go really fast. And so they're always surprised when they find that the journalist wants to just listen. And, you know, I think that that has everything to do with transparency, because transparency has everything to do with openness. You come to a situation, you're transparent about what you're going to do, you're open to what might happen, not expecting that something will go one way or another. I mean, that's a bit of a distance from the original question, I think, but it's all related in my mind.
Laura Black?
Yeah, if I could add. So thinking about transparency in terms of biomedical ethics, I think of it in a way when we think of autonomy, which is having the ability to make decisions for yourself. And the most concrete example that folks might be familiar with is consent. So when you're going to have a procedure or you're going to enter into a clinical trial, you have a consent. And so without transparency to as far as you're able to, that patient or research subject does not fulfill their autonomous decision-making because they don't have the information. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yet the limit for transparency is half the people, I mean, in many trials, half will get a placebo and half will get the test, the real test. And if, in the interest of transparency, oh, we should tell them. But you can't because it screws up the clinical trial. So there's always a but, or there's always a limit.
Yeah, to the line that you're able. So things like risks and benefits and what to expect, those are definitely the tenets of transparency.
Let's talk about accountability and when things go wrong and how do we sort of self-monitor in our professions, in our organizations, and in ourselves to sort of, you know, do we monitor our own ethics, our own integrity? Steve, you want to start with that?
You're asking great questions because...
He's shaking his head as I ask that question.
Well, my research in the past, I don't know, 30 years, there are sort of five attributes of a culture of integrity, whether that's a university or a newspaper or public television or public radio or a small law firm or a big healthcare institution like Sanford or Vera. And we touched on one, which is having a culture where people can speak up. And that is one of the two weakest links in most organizations around the world. And the other is accountability. The other is, wow, we got a star newspaper reporter who's misbehaving, violating our codes. We'll counsel her or we'll talk to him, but we're not going to get rid of him. Or we've got a star salesperson or a star law partner or a star anybody. I think it happens with physicians too. And we don't want to hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. And certainly when the you-know-what hits the fan, let's look not too far away at Wells Fargo when their deceptive sales practices came to light, 2 years after they first came to light. And what did the then CEO say? He blamed 5,000 individual employees for their individual acts of misconduct and took no responsibility for the systems and incentives that promoted that behavior in the first place and didn't ferret it out in the second place. So it's hard, though. I mean, saying I was wrong, saying it was my mistake, you know, just think about it as an individual. It's tough. And then magnify it to an organization with tens or hundreds or thousands of people. It's a tough
thing. Does that make it worse, the refusal, the refusal or the hesitation to say I was wrong? I mean, you mentioned Wells Fargo. That's how you end up as a Saturday Night Live skit with Lin-Manuel Miranda singing about the Wells Fargo wagon, right?
Yeah.
So if you jump on that, and does accountability help sort of stem the tide?
Well, in an area, you know, in the area of Sanford or Vera in healthcare, there's research that says if someone in your institution makes a mistake and you say, I made a mistake or we made a mistake and I apologize, they're actually less likely to sue you for malpractice than if you cover it up, which is...
Is that true? We're nodding our heads. Is that true? So if a doctor says, you know what, we missed that one, we made a mistake, is that encouraged behavior in the medical profession? Or is there hesitation to say that because you're afraid you're going to be sued?
Yeah, I think that I think it could go either way, but I've also seen the same research, and as a nurse, I can appreciate that patients really just want to know. It goes back to the transparency and being honest.
Yeah. And plus, with social media, now, I mean, look, everything comes out. There are no secrets, really.
Yeah.
So I think the media advice is, you know, get out in front, take responsibility, apologize, and that's the best. I mean, it's still going to be hell, but that's the best chance you have of surviving the hell.
Janet Blank-Leber, Augie, journalism professor, your thoughts?
Journalists are accountable all the time. If they make mistakes, then they account for them in the newspaper or online minutes later. And I think that in the current culture, journalists are being are ready and willing to be accountable to show the world that they are not the crooked media that our president is fond of calling them, the crooked media. I know a lot of journalists, and they are among the hardest working of people I know, and people of integrity. So I kind of grow weary of the stereotype of the journalist who just wants a story. I think the journalists are working always to be accountable, and they do a good job of it.
Maybe you haven't dug into this yet because it's sort of breaking news in the past couple days, but the New York Times is talking about conversations between President Trump's campaign staff and Russia. There's some undisclosed sources. So just in general, when do reporters keep, for people who are wondering, and the president says there's leaks, we've got that problem, we've got a problem with the media. Just in general, not disclosing a source as a reporter.
Yeah, it's hard.
What are the guidelines there? What's the ethic?
I think that when the information is of such vital importance to the public, that journalists are going to accept information that comes to them via leaks. You know, one of the classic cases of all time is the Pentagon Papers, and that individual's belief was that the public had a right and a need to know what was in those documents. And I think that there are individuals now who are doing the same thing. And so they see themselves as being accountable because they are bringing information forward that might otherwise be buried and that we need to have and that we need to think about and that we need to act upon.
Right.
And that's to be accountable.
It's not just government. What was the Academy Award winner Best Picture last year about the Boston Globe?
Spotlight.
Yeah.
Spotlight. Great film.
Yeah. Again,
it's a really good
protecting film. Protecting people because of sources who would come forward only on the conditions of anonymity.
Yeah. So. Yes.
Right. Bob Freeberg, accountability, and
in our profession.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Have you seen Spotlight? Because certainly that part of that was, you know, pulling out some of those, sort of agreements that were made between, litigants and the Catholic Church. That, you know, the legal impression was highly involved in that movie. So let's talk accountability with lawyers.
Well, the lawyers, in terms of our rules, we have a rule that says if you see a lawyer violating, in other words, an unethical activity, you are obliged to report that. And if you fail to report it, then you are subject to some discipline yourself. The nuances of all of that, of course, are the competing pressures to represent your client, the unpopular cause, and people will attribute to the lawyer the feelings they have toward the opposite party.
Right.
For example, we would get and still do get complaints from folks engaged in divorce, which is frequently a contentious thing, who complain about the lawyer representing the other party.
Sure.
Who really has only done what he or she thinks is the best thing to do for his or her client. So, but the accountability, I think, in the sense that to be accountable to your client is held together, well, partly just by your own integrity, obviously. You want to do the best job you can for the person that you're trying to help. But it also gets bound up with the understanding that you have to be responsible and accountable for what you do. And sometimes that means you get fired or you have to fire your client.
Hmm. We're going to take a quick break. We want to hear from you in this conversation. You can give us a call at 800-524-3604. Ask a question of someone on our panel on air. That's 800-524-3604. We'll take a quick break and be back. You're listening to In the Moment, South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending this hour talking about ethics. We're broadcasting live from the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. I'll reintroduce our panel here in a moment, but we do want to hear from you. If you have a question about ethics for any of our guests, you can give us a call at 800-524-3604. You can send me a text at 956-SDPB, or you can email inthemoment@sdpb.org. We've got about 10 minutes left in our conversation, and it looks like we've got a phone call coming here in a minute. So you've got a few minutes left to give us a call. I'll introduce our guests real quick. Laura Black is Senior Director for Clinical Research at Sanford Research. Janet Blank-Libra is with Augustana University. She's a professor, director of journalism, has written the book called Pursuing an Ethic of Empathy in Journalism. Bob Freeberg is an attorney and counsel for the South Dakota State Bar Association Disciplinary Board. And Steve Priest is with Integrity Insight International, working across the globe, 51 countries, business ethics. We have a phone call here, and I'm going to try to figure out real quick how to make sure our guests can hear that. Dave from Mitchell. Dave, can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you go ahead and ask your question?
Yeah, I wanted to make a brief comment and then ask for their responses to it. I teach in the field of ethics as well as your colleague on the program.
We lost Dave for a minute. He teaches in the field. Okay, Dave, can you hear me now?
Yeah, should I go ahead?
You're cutting out. I lost you when you said you teach in the field of ethics. Start from there, please.
Yeah, and I wanted to raise a couple of ideas for the panel to respond to in terms of what we mean by ethics. It seems to me that the conversations so far have had a decidedly what I call a micro tilt. That is to say, ethics is about individual people making good decisions because they are virtuous, which is certainly a part of ethics. But there's another whole dimension which has to do with making good policy decisions and trying to figure out what the right decision, the best decision is. And I haven't heard a lot from the panel at this point about that aspect of ethics.
Perfect, Dave.
Just a quick illustration. The word nuance was used at one point in response to transparency. It seems to me that's a classic case where the right thing to do with regard to transparency is not obvious, and you can have people with good motivation who have decidedly different views on what's the right thing to do. So I'm interested in what the panel might have to say on that.
All right, Dave, thanks for that. Sorry about the feedback there as I tried to figure out how our guests could hear Dave's question. I've been asking some kind of micro questions there. Let's broaden it out a little bit and talk about policy and beyond the nuances. Who wants to begin with that?
Well, I take a stab at it, but I don't have any expertise about it, but I would just say that if you're going to take that view, then you have to take a whole lot, have to depend a little bit on your own philosophy, upon your own theology. How do you view the world, and how do you view the questions of right and wrong? And there's a variety, I think, of responsible answers to that whole issue. And so, I agree with the questioner that it is important to have an anchor or a direction when you're making policy. But I also think then you have to broaden the debate into, you know, what do you got in your gut or in your heart? You know, what makes you tick? And there's a lot of variety, I think, in the world.
Yeah. Laura?
So thinking about public policy and ethics, so ethics and morals, there's the intersection there. And so we definitely need underlying ethical principles that we all can agree upon when we are thinking of public policy. But knowing that what's in our heart or what's in our gut may differ from person to person. So how do we develop public policy that's wide-reaching enough that covers what we all can somewhat agree on, or at least we have foundational principles to support? And then how do we deal with the moral conflicts that we have in those policies? And there's plenty of examples for that. And I think the other piece, too, that I'd like to throw out there when we think about public policy is knowing that morals change, and with technologies and new I'm thinking biotechnologies, there's always something more that we're learning, and I'm sure it's the same in your field. And so our views change, and so we have to be cognizant that policies also need to change, and sometimes the policies are slower to change than the way that we practice. And
morals change. What do you mean? What's culturally accepted?
Culturally accepted,
time?
Yeah.
Okay.
So just thinking about, you know, what as a society do we find acceptable, and knowing that that changes, and not only does it change, but it changes because the decisions we have to make change. So as technology advances, science advances, there's situations that we haven't had to deal with before that we need to consider. So thinking of, you know, physician-assisted dying, you think about all of these cases that were really pronounced in the 60s and how that really framed the way that our public policy deals with end of life. And
Sure. Steve, Dave from Mitchell teaches in ethics as well, wants to broaden the conversation from some of the nuances to creating effective policy that addresses ethics.
Well, Dave caught me because Aristotle is my favorite ethical philosopher, and he's a virtue ethics guy. So, Dave, well done. I'm going to go really big, global. I want to and talk about an issue that is on the hearts and minds, according to the polls, of Americans and Romanians and Russians and Indians, and that's bribery and corruption. And we as America like to be a leader. We like to be the best in bribery and corruption. In quite a credible ranking, it's been going on for 20 years by a group called Transparency International. There we go, Transparency again. The U.S. is in the low teens. There are like 15 countries rated better in bribery and corruption than us. Still optimistic.
Because of our behavior or because of the protections against it? Because when we had the conversation about initiated Measure 22, South Dakota, the proponents of it said South Dakota is rated so low for corruption, or, you know, at risk for corruption. And then the folks who were opponents said, yeah, but that's not, doesn't mean it's actually happening. It just means that some of the stop gaps are not in place, so don't get carried away. So when you say that...
The transparency index is a measure of perceptions of corruption by people who would be in a position to know, the bribers or the bribees. And here's where I want to highlight the key roles of two of the three professions here. I mean, we all know the good healthcare does, but one of the major correlations, and I would say not just correlations, but causes of societies where bribery is less likely to happen and corruption is less likely to happen, is a healthy fourth estate, a healthy media, and the rule of law. And when the rule of law begins to crumble and the role of the media, the independent media, begins to be called into question. The corruption indices just go crazy. And so it's great. We're in a challenging time, right? We can say we're in the top 20, and that's good. Or we can say, geez, really, in the United States, we should be top 10. So that's going big and going medium. It's all about the conversation. When you can have an open, honest conversation with people of goodwill, and you're not going to be penalized or killed for something you say that might be in disagreement with something somebody else says, that's when we win. There are some counterexamples in the literature, but you're more likely to get good decisions when a small group of people who are on a relatively even platform can sit down and talk in an atmosphere of civility, which is, darn it, one of the things that South Dakota and Minnesota and the upper Midwest is supposed to be known for, and I hope we can claim that and keep it.
All right, so we're going to wrap up here with the last couple minutes and say thank you to all our guests. And Janet, I want to go back to you as the end, because when I was in school the last year, I was there with you studying ethics, and now South Dakota Public Broadcasting, you know, you come here, there's a policy manual on ethics from NPR that you're given access to online so you can read it. And then there's that individual person that I get to go to on a daily basis, minute by minute, at any hour of the day. And for me, that's Director of Radio, Kara Hetland. You can ask her anything. Mm-hmm. So very quickly, do you want to end with the importance of an individual mentor and, people sitting down one-on-one to have those tough ethical conversations as you learn your job, which never ends?
Oh, wow, that's a hard question, Lori.
And you got 30 seconds.
It's all come around. I think that any time we sit down with someone and we have a conversation about how they're going to approach something that's really challenging, my goal is to get the individual I'm sitting with to become more discerning about whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so to apply a variety of lenses to think about what the different outcomes would be given the different approaches, and in the end, to hope that the more discerning and the more mindful we are, the more likely it is that we'll reach a right or a just or a good conclusion. And that's what I would hope for in a conversation like that.
Janet Blank-Libra is Augustana University Professor, Director of Journalism. Janet, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori.
Laura Black, Senior Director for Clinical Research at Sanford Research. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
Bob Freeberg, Attorney and Counsel for the South Dakota State Bar Association Disciplinary Board. Bob, it's been a pleasure to meet you in person. Heard so much about you, so thanks for joining us.
I just don't believe everything you might hear about me.
And Steve Priest, he's with Integrity Insight International, travels the world working with different businesses on ethics, etc. Steve, thank you.
Much fun. Thank you.